Chapter 27. Forest Fire. The Courage of Shepherds. Into the Labyrinth. Flights of gunships roared over the mountain, dropping Promethean bombs that kindled blazes even in the wet wood of the quick trees. Teardrops of blackened forest, limbed by fire, crawled along before the wind.
"You are still offering resistance," stated Corvo.
Mericus was surprised by Corvo's words. The captain had said very little to him. Everyone was preoccupied, nervously watching the trees.
Yeah, we are. The situation isn't quite so bad as it looks from the outside, maybe. They've taken the top of the mountain, but the lower chambers are still ours, and we're operating out of some of the more obscure caves.
Corvo's helm swept back and forth as he examined the mountain battlefield.
It cannot last. You're right, said Mericus. It can't. You are remarkably relaxed.
You expect me to be gibbering in terror, Mericus snorted.
We're not all cowards. Damn few of us are. These men here, he waved his hand back at his depleted command. They've been fighting hard. They've killed a few of you legionaries. Do you know that? They're braver than your lot, if you ask me. They fear, and they conquer it, said Corvo. That is worthy of respect. But they're not frightened. They're terrified, Captain. They know what the Night Lords will do to us if they catch us. We know the stakes, but we won't give up. None of us expect to live very long.
They took to a Fantine road, a track of smooth earth smashed through the trees by the great beasts and pounded rock hard by generations in their passing. The quick trees were not entirely defeated and curved over the way, enclosing it in a tunnel of green.
We'll go quicker here, and we'll be harder to track, said Mericus.
This is not a human path, said Corvo. What manner of animal made it?
Big ones, said Mericus. This area is far out from the city, and thick with them any other time, but they've been driven off by the fighting. Be glad of it, they're short-tempered.
On the road, the going was easier. Out of the woods, the disparity between the Space Marines and the Sothern's ability to march became apparent. Mericus sensed the frustration of the Space Marines at having to move at a human pace, but they did not abandon the Sothern's. Mericus wondered if such mercy would cost them the war in the end. Soon they were climbing the mountain's foothills through choking spirals of smoke. They left the road and the danger from the fires grew. It was only the blindest chance that did not see the men obliterated directly by the fires creeping through the forest. Several times they had to alter their route to avoid the conflagration. They could see very little, and the auxiliaries struggled to breathe in the fumes rolling out of the burning woods. Quicktree wood was wet and did not readily combust, and the smoke it put out when it did was thick and white with steam. Ash drifted down, grey and white and black, thick as drifting snow in places. Presently, Obadiah called a halt in a clearing before a point where the hillside reared up, its gentle slope becoming precipitous where a cliff tore through the ground. The rock of it was covered in vegetation, and Mericus could see nothing on its eroded face except dark green foliage and the occasional patch of mossy stone, but his men were pointing out something in the leaves.
"The Triple Cave," said Hasquin. "The furthest entrance into the mountain that's been found.
Back in the old days, before the city, the further herders used it as shelter. Fantines wouldn't go near it."
"I don't see anything," said Mericus.
The cliff was so choked in swiftvine it resembled a hoary old face, a forest god out of time, rather than a rock formation.
"There," said Hasquin.
He rested his arm on Mericus's shoulder and pointed out three darker patches set at staggered intervals in the vines. Mericus squinted.
"You move well, Sarge," said Tiny Jono, "but you've got to be Sothern-born to see the caves in the trees here."
"Ain't that the truth," said Dorican.
He and Chelvin set down Domitia. The day was hot. The fires made it hotter. They were streaming with sweat, but they had not complained at the weight of their gun.
"This is our way in," said Corvo. "Sergeant?"
"Yeah, I know," said Mericus. "You need to leave us behind. We're slowing you down."
Corvo's expression was hidden by his helmet, but he bowed slightly in the affirmative.
"I advise you to scatter,"
Head upwards. The Night Lords will be following us by now, and they will catch you if you linger nearby.
We've nowhere to go. Not really.
What if you fail? Said Mericus.
We may, but it is not your concern. You have played your part. Depart with your lives, said Corvo.
We can do better than run off and hide and wait to die, burned up or hauled off, said Mericus.
We'll cover you, buy you some time. We're tough to spot from the air, but you, no offense, once they find your drop pods, the trail you left will be all too easy to follow. I thought quick trees were pretty robust, but you've made a sight of a mess.
Corvo made a disapproving noise that came out of his vox grill as a metallic buzz.
It is not necessary for you to risk your lives.
Oh, but it is, said Mericus. This beacon is a big thing. The fate of the galaxy, all that. But this is about more than the end of the universe for us. This is our home.
You are a very flippant man.
Thanks, said Mericus.
I did not mean it as a compliment.
I know. It's just the way I am. I wasn't born here, Captain, but this is where I belong. We'll fight for Sotha. We'll fight for our home.
The Sothans formed up behind Mericus, the remains of the three squads that had set out on patrol what seemed like 100 years ago. Hasquin, Chelvan, Dorican, his dour persona unruffled by the conflict. Pontian was dead, Morio still wounded and succumbing to infection. Hanspire gone. Most of Balarian's men, too. Governisk was with them, but had withdrawn into himself, relinquishing all authority to Mericus. Vitellius lived, cooped up in the mountain with the three of his men who knew the passageways best. There were 14 of them with Mericus. That was all. Men who expected to do their yearly tour of duty, then go back to their jobs and families. Their uniforms were so dirty that the original colours were unidentifiable, and their faces weren't much cleaner. They were a ragged tribe in the face of the Ultramarines captain in his pristine armour. But they stood tall and proud.
So, we'll stay here, thank you very much, said Mericus, and do what we can. I acknowledge your previous efforts, but a large force will come after us, not a patrol, or a handful caught by surprise. Your weapons are not well suited to fighting the Legionis Astartes, said Corvo. Your courage is praiseworthy, but you would serve better by fleeing and living to fight under better circumstances.
These torches, Mericus touched the stock of his las rifle. They're not the best, but they'll still put a Night Lord down if you hit him enough times in the right places. And you are forgetting Domitia and her sisters. We still have them. He pointed at Dorican, who slapped the side of his heavy bolter emphatically.
3 heavy bolters will make them stop and think, said Mericus.
We are the shepherds of Sotha. They will never see us, said Hasquin. Not until it's too late.
These crags are a good position for an ambush, you reckon, Mericus?
Said Governisk. He pointed to a vine-choked shelf about halfway up.
Their firing angles will be poor, will be difficult to get at. We should take a fair tally of them.
Obadiah, who had been waiting by the side of the captain, bent low and scooped up a large rock. He tossed it without effort to where Governisk pointed.
Imagine that is a grenade. You have to get higher, he said.
We can get higher, said Mericus.
With heavy bolters, said Obadiah skeptically. Listen to the captain, please. Hide somewhere. Do not throw your lives away. That's sheer rock. One of your Quarians might do it, but can you?
Mericus grinned solemnly.
Where a Quarian can go, a Sothan can go. And where a Sothan can go, he can drag a gun.
The last of the Space Marines came through the cave entrance. The swift vines creaked shut behind them, cutting what little light came inside to a murky green. Ptolemachus and Solon took 5 men each into the other caves and had them stamp about in the leaf mould. As was the norm with the tunnels of the Pharos, debris from the outside world gave out dramatically quickly, and the treated black stone that made up the tunnels was impervious to the Space Marine's ceramite boots. With false trails laid, it would take more than a cursory examination for the Night Lords to discern which way they had gone. The three tunnels, despite their outward similarity, were different in character. The lowest went on for a kilometre before curving down at a sharp angle to become a tubular pit 100 metres deep. Solon had been on the mapping expedition for that one, lowered down on ropes to find it terminating in a perfect bowl of black stone. The upper tunnel wound its way on random curves for thousands of metres, twisting back upon itself twice before abruptly narrowing into three tiny apertures that went off in different directions. The middle tunnel went straight on towards the mountain and the Pharos, joining with the main system there. Corvo's strike force went far enough that they were all within. Obadiah was at the head with Corvo and Tebekai. He glanced back at the green curtain of the entrance, wishing he were back outside. "This is the way, Captain Corvo," said Obadiah. At the thought of going back into the tunnels, his voice quavered, and he cursed himself inwardly.
"Tell me what to expect."
"The tunnels are extensive and mostly unknown. We had mapped maybe 10% reliably before the invasion, at least so Magos Carantine told me, Captain."
"Reliably?"
"Getting accurate readings is hard, and they don't always seem to be the same, my lord," said Tebekai. Corvo grunted. He had evidently seen stranger things in his time. "This tunnel is the furthest out from the mountain," said Tebekai. "It's about 20 kilometres to the main chambers at the centre. It's not bad going to begin with, perfectly level for the first 3 kilometres, but it branches at the mountain and the path we need takes on gradient. It's shallow at first, but increases in steepness," he muttered under his breath. "Or it did, the last time we looked."
"I take it these caverns are not simply caverns, Neophyte," said Corvo.
Obadiah drew in a shaking breath. "Captain, we had an incident here. Well, the lion himself ordered us not to speak of it," said Tebekai, finishing the sentence for him.
"Then do not," Corvo said with a respectful nod.
Obadiah relaxed a little. "The upper levels have walkways put in by Warsmith Dantioch and the Mechanicum teams. The major tunnels of the lower complex have them too, those that lead to locations that have a direct bearing on the functioning of the Pharos." Obadiah parroted words spoken him by Arcus long months ago, before they began the mapping initiative. It comforted him to be repeating information from before, when life was secure. "The material of the tunnels has some odd properties."
"Such as?" asked Corvo.
"Light absorption, and at sunset and sunrise, light emission," said Obadiah. "Lord Dantioch calls it the light event, but the Sothans call it the light song," said Tebekai. "For a few seconds, the tunnels fill with golden light."
"Noted. That will stand to our advantage. The Night Lords dislike bright light."
"The main..."
Corvo held up his hand.
"The others have returned. It is time to move on. Continue your explanation as we march, Neophyte. Column, double pace. Support squads to the rear."
Corvo set off at a lope, his long legs eating up distance. Obadiah cast a final look behind him. Now the Sothans were no longer with them, the column of space marines went faster. "There are steep slopes and sudden drops, and it is hard to maintain purchase in those places," continued Obadiah. "We must remain on the path. If we leave it, we will become lost. The walls baffle Orspex and most other scanning techniques."
"So you had to map it all manually," said Corvo.
His speech came easily from his vox grill. The pace they went was achievable for the scouts, but they panted as they ran. Corvo did not. Tebekai gave Obadiah a sidelong glance. "My lord, this is a strange mountain." The tunnel closed in around them, fluidly organic, like the tubule in an organ of an unimaginable creature. The light from the mouth dwindled away to a grey-green suggestion. The weight of stone and years pressed hard on Obadiah. The tunnel widened. Two apertures presented themselves, the left an extreme horizontal ellipse, the right a tall circle. Obadiah slowed and stopped. The column following him and Tebekai did the same. He looked into the darkness of the cave. Something deep down looked back into him. "And they shall know no fear."
He took a hesitant step forward. And they shall know no fear. The voice in his mind became hysterical, a parody of the recordings of the Emperor. I am not afraid, he told himself. I am not afraid. But he was afraid, and he should not be. He was not afraid of the Night Lords, or dying, or fighting. He was afraid of the deep cold under the earth. He was afraid of the endless turns and twists of the tunnels. He was afraid of the great machine, still impossibly functioning after millions of years. He was afraid of the things he heard whispering from the shadows. He was afraid of the revelations that waited for him, eager to spill more of the universe's boundless horrors into his mind. But most of all, he was afraid of the dark.
Is there a problem, Neophyte? Have you lost your way? Asked Corvo.
No, he said. I have not. It is the right-hand branch. It will take us deep into the mountain, past primary location Beta, and on towards the quantum engines.
Then proceed.
Yes, Captain Corvo.
They shall know no fear.
The Emperor's words echoing in his mind, Obadiah choked down his unease.
He stepped out of the last dying glow of the Sothan sun and into the endless, alien deeps of the Pharos.
The Sothans did not have long to wait for their pursuers. Before an hour was out, they came into the clearing. They were savages, far removed in appearance from the polished uniformity of the Ultramarines. Their dark blue armor was covered in the images of death, skulls painted upon their face masks. Their squad markings were small and often obscured, their plates festooned with jangling chains from which hung the bones of their victims. Skulls were gathered at their waists in obscene bunches. Some of the warriors were wearing masks over their helms. A moment passed before Mericus realized they were the stretched, tanned faces of their victims. One wore a long cloak made of skin. Lightning patterns flickered over the larger plates of some of them. There were other images playing there, bright and red. Mericus was glad he could not see them. There were at least 60 traitors, 20 in plain view in the clearing before the cave mouth. The movement of the quick trees left and right betrayed the presence of more. The thick saplings crowding the edge of the clearing parted.
Now, asked Dorican.
Wait, whispered Mericus. There are more coming to the left and right. We must catch as many as possible if we're to help the others.
He made no mention of their own survival. There was no chance of that. The Night Lords gathered below their position. One of them was a tracker of some kind, pointing out the marks of the Ultramarine's passage to his superiors. One bore a massive axe, while another carried a glaive.
Mericus, they're gonna see us soon. Pretend you're on a Fantine drive, Hasquin, said Mericus. These aren't Fantines. They'll kill you just the same if you make a mistake. Hold your fire.
More of the Night Lords were coming into the clearing. Despite their ill-favored look, they were disciplined and fanned out to secure the area. Their commanders were directly beneath them, night blue monsters in cloaks of scarlet. Mericus shrank back into the scrubby plants of the ledge.
Now! We have to open fire now!
Hissed Chelvan. Mericus shook his head. More of the enemy were converging on the clearing. Their guard never faltered, with their bolters up, heads and weapons tracking together as they covered every centimetre of the terrain. A Night Lord looked toward the concealed heavy weapons. Mericus flinched, but they were not noticed. Corvo's force had made no effort to hide their passing, but had instead damaged the vegetation around each cave mouth. The Night Lords fanned out, silently sending recon parties inside. The rest retreated into the brush and kept watch. There was still not enough of their total number in the clearing for Mericus's liking, but there was never going to be a perfect moment. Better they preserve the element of surprise.
Fire!
He shouted, abandoning stealth. Let the bastards know who killed them. He wanted them to be aware as they died that mere mortals had brought them low. The bass chugging of three heavy bolters was deafening, drowning out the almost pathetic-sounding crack of lasguns. The lasbeams stabbed out at the Space Marines to little effect. But when large-caliber mass reactives thundered into the lead Night Lords on jets of short-lived fire, they easily penetrated Warplate. Ceramite ruptured as it struggled to contain the explosions. Blood burst from huge wounds. One Night Lord lost his arm, another his head. Five were dead before they realized what was happening, more gravely injured or knocked off their feet by the force of the impacts. Mericus's triumphant grin turned to a frown. He never expected them to react so quickly. There was no confusion as he would have expected from a human soldier, no wild weapons discharge. They smoothly fell into a covering fire pattern, those closest to the tree line aiming up at the rocks, stepping backwards as they shot, those furthest running full pelt into the cover of the trees. Bolt shells burst all around the Sothern's vantage point, peppering them with painful splinters of rock. But Governisk had been correct. Their angles of fire were poor. As the rock face below them was shattered into chips, the men of the Sothern First remained unharmed.
"We got them on the run!"
shouted Yontan, one of Governisk's men. He stood up to better aim his lasgun and paid for his rashness with a bolt round to his torso. Yontan ceased to exist as a human being, his remains showering them with fragments of flesh.
"Stay down!" screamed Mericus at the men.
The elation of battle flooded him, and the heady mix of fear and adrenaline birthed in him a ferocious joy. Mericus's world shrank to a sphere centered on the clearing. Each burst of propellant as the bolts ignited on their way out of the heavy bolter barrels was a starburst. The smell of shattering rock was sharp and invigorating. The leaves of the trees took on an emerald luster. Most glorious of all was to see the Night Lords run from the wrath of smaller men. It could never last. A Night Lord came to the edge of the trees with a missile launcher, his fellows round him in a protective formation.
"Kill the heavy weapon!" shouted Mericus.
Dorican tracked the bolter around, never taking his finger off the trigger. Large-caliber mass reactives blew small craters in the black soil and stitched up the chest of the traitor. He fired as he died. The rocket went wide of its mark, shooting over the Sothern's heads. On the cliff above their position, the missile exploded, bringing a tumble of rock down over the middle heavy bolter. Men screamed as they were pelted with rubble. The bolter collapsed on its bipod, the gunner dead.
"Arm out!" yelled Dorican.
Chelvin was up, a bulky replacement magazine in his hand. He slapped it into place and hit Dorican on the shoulder. Mericus saw the Night Lord aiming for Chelvin, aiming a killing shot from 100 meters away. He shoved at Chelvin's legs, but the bolt caught him anyway. His arm blew free, the impact sending Chelvin screaming 40 meters down the cliff.
"That was all our ammunition," shouted Hasquin.
"Dorican, make every bolt count,"
said Mericus. He was calm, far calmer than he had ever been in his life. Perhaps this was how the Legionis Astartes felt, fearless.
"Look to the left. They're coming up the sides."
The Night Lords were clambering up the cliff face, making huge power-assisted leaps, their fingers digging fresh handholds into the rock. One slipped and fell from a height that would have slain a mortal man, but he scrambled up unharmed and went for a second attempt. Mericus crawled past Dorican as he panned his weapon around. Night Lords died on the cliff face. The chugging of the weapon battered at his head. Mericus felt something go in his ear. His hearing dimmed, the sounds of the battle muffled by a painful ringing. On his belly, Mericus made his way to the position of the second bolter team. The avalanche had crushed them, and Mericus had to shove blood-sticky loose stone out of the way to get at the dead loader. Rolling one large boulder free, Mericus found him. The leather magazine pouches were close to his fingertips. With a smile of relief, he reached for them, undid a clasp stiff with grit, and pulled out a full clip, grunting at the weight of it.
"Dorican! I have it!"
His triumph was short-lived. A roaring shook the world. Shouting penetrated the ringing in his ruined ears. Bangs of close-range gunfire and the heavy bolters fell silent. He rolled over onto his back and was confronted with the stuff of nightmares. A Night Lord towered over him, the turbo fans of his jump pack wickering. He wore sleeves of human skin over his arms.
His mask was cast in the shape of a leering skull, small bat wings either side of it.
"Look what we have here,"
dispassionately pronounced. The words struck an awful stomach-turning fear into Mericus.
"More flesh for the flensing."
The Night Lord reached his obscenely clad hand down and grabbed Mericus's shirt, hauling him to his feet. Three other jump troops landed on the ledge. Only seven of Mericus's command remained alive, their hands on their heads and fear plain on their faces.
"Take them back to Lord Kellenvar," the monster ordered his comrades.
The Night Lords reached for men who wept open tears of terror. They were careless of their great strength, breaking the bones of mortal limbs as they seized their prey. Jump pack jets ignited with throaty roars. The Space Marines leapt into the air. Mericus dangled from his captor's hand like an infant taken by a giant in a story. He swung uncomfortably, felt something wrench in his shoulder. The Night Lord turned glaring helm lenses on him and dropped him to the ground. Mericus fell hard, sprawling on the sparse grasses. He struggled to his feet, finding himself in a crowd of looming giants. One of them slapped him hard across the cheek, breaking his teeth and sending him reeling. He spat blood, tried to stand, but a second blow broke his nose and spun him into the red darkness of unconsciousness. It was a state he would long for many times before the end.